taking a look at climate and weather on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Must be the last Monday of the month. By golly, it is. March 31st, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, with us right now. John Martin will be with us soon. He's got a class to teach, but he'll be here in maybe 10 minutes or so. He chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. In the meantime, if you have some questions about the weather or about our climate, we hope you'll join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison, you can reach us at 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions. And Steve Ackerman, welcome back.
It's good to be here in wonderful spring of Wisconsin.
Where it's, if listeners may have heard some loud noises, that was thunder.
There was a big clash of thunder just before I came over here, which made me grab my umbrella, thankfully, because, man, it was pouring on the way down here. So the south is southern Wisconsin. Almost all of southern Wisconsin is raining right now, and snow in the middle of Wisconsin, maybe further north, too.
Well, for at least the southern part of the state, it's warm enough so we don't have more snow.
Yes, and I guess people are thankful about that. I've missed a lot of the snow being in D.C. most of the year, but I was looking forward to experiencing a good snowfall.
Well, I'll tell you what. It's an experience that is,
can be forgotten.
Easily forgotten. Joe in Franklin has a question for you, so let's go to Joe. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Larry and Steve.
What?
Actually, if you hear any noise in the background, it's the rain pounding on the roof of my car.
Okay.
I know what rain is. I know what snow is. But what is sleet and freezing rain? What's the difference between them? What type of atmospheric conditions cause them? What type of temperatures, things like that?
Ah, good question. Yeah, first thing that a lot of people don't realize is that most precipitation, whether it be snow, rain, freezing rain, or sleet, in Wisconsin was at one time frozen, even in the summertime. And so when we get rain, what happens is that frozen particles, they melt, and so they become rain. And if they don't melt, then there's snow.
Mm-hmm.
And we get this a lot in the spring and fall and in the wintertime. If we get what we call an inversion near the ground, so normally the temperature decreases as we go up away from the surface, but sometimes we'll find that the temperature will increase as we go up from the surface and then decrease. And if that happens, sometimes as you go up higher above the ground, while the ground may be freezing, up above it's not. And so as these snowflakes fall out of the cloud, they hit this layer of warm air where they melt. And then they fall through this warm layer and enter another layer near the ground where it's below freezing. If that layer is deep enough, then those newly melted raindrops will freeze again. And you'll get little solid drops of clear ice. And that's what sleet is. If they don't have enough time to freeze in that layer because it's not deep enough, but the ground is still frozen, then when those raindrops hit the ground, they'll freeze when they hit the ground. And that's what freezing rain is.
Okay, so sleet is actually frozen water that's falling, and freezing rain is water that's falling and freezes that hits the ground.
Exactly, yep. Now, okay. Sometimes in the radio, you hear people will call it sleeting outside when you have a mixture of rain and snow, and that is not sleet. That's a mixture of rain and snow. It's not sleet. The raindrops have to refreeze and form little solid balls of ice.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Joe, for calling. Appreciate it. And more callers online. Jim in Wausau, your turn. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
A couple months ago, I was at a used book sale and picked up a copy of Carl Sagan's book, Broca's Brain. And much to my surprise, in it, there's a chapter that he reproduces from an article he wrote in 1975 on the climates of planets, in which he talks about the dangers of declining temperatures in planets. And so I'm wondering about the theory of global warming. When was it that climatologists changed from essentially global cooling to global warming? And I'm interested as to whether it was just the new climatologists that adopted the new theory, or did everybody sort of swing over?
Pretty much everyone is swung over. And I'm glad you raised that, because I've been in my mind trying to remember, because I remember reading someplace from either Carl Sagan or some other scientist in the early 70s about cooling occurring, because climatologically that's what they were expecting. And when I say climatologically, I'm talking now, 6,000, 10,000 year cycles. And so that was the mental exercise back then, was looking at, okay, what's going to happen when it's going to be cooling? But it soon turned around to saying, well, okay, that's not what's happening. What's happening is what we would expect to happen due to human impacts is that we might get a global warming. But all through the 80s, you know, a lot of people were still talking about that possibility, but it really wasn't until about the mid-90s where enough of the data began to all point in the same direction that warming was occurring. So, yeah, in the 70s, late 60s, they were talking about potentials for cooling. By the late 70s, 80s, people were saying, no, we should be going into warming. And by the mid-90s, all the evidence was kind of falling into place that said, yeah, there's a global warming going on.
Okay. Thank
all
you
right.
for the history.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And, of course, what we heard all winter, at least in southern Wisconsin, was the global warming is a bunch of baloney because we're sitting there with 100 inches of snow.
Yeah, and I think Wisconsin, the entire state was somewhere between, well, it was all below normal in terms of its temperature. So not only did the southern part get a lot more than normal breeze, the entire state was below normal temperature. But remember, you can't look at any one day or any one month. You have to look at the trends in things. And so even though we were below normal, it wasn't an abnormally freezing cold winter. It was an abnormal precipitation snowfall winter for sure, but not temperature-wise.
Is it accurate to say that a heavy snow season in any part of the Midwest or the Great Lakes depends on the upper air patterns set in place by the Pacific Ocean? And
yeah, we need really two things. We need some upper air patterns that are going to allow the air to rise. And usually that's why you hear people tracking the jet stream, because it's in the vicinity of the jet stream is where we get what we call upper level support, which means air is allowed to rise from the surface and go high into the atmosphere. And the second thing that we need, and I think this is what we got a lot of this year, is a combination of these two things, was moisture near the surface. And so I think this year we got a lot of Gulf moisture, so moisture coming up from the Gulf of Mexico into our region. And we have the jet stream in the right place that the storms just kept coming over and over and over. It was really kind of fun if you were living in southern Wisconsin to look and just see it. Every time a storm was coming, it was bringing not only tracking right over the southern Wisconsin region, but bringing good amounts of moisture and snowfall.
It sure was.
Yeah. Unless you were in northern Wisconsin, then probably you didn't like it too much.
Sherry in Madison has a question for you. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, I've pulled off the interstate so I can talk. I signed up for this thing with something in Colorado called CoRob, and you do all these measurements.
You do snowfall measurements, right, or hail measurements?
Yeah, rain. And I was doing real when it first started, but then with the weather that we got, it was like after the first big snow, all the storms we got, the rain and the snow and the sleet were coming sideways, and nothing would go into the gauge. I tried putting things in the ground, and it was like I finally gave up because I couldn't get a proper measurement anymore with the weird weather we had this winter. What do you do?
You do what you were doing. You try different things. You're right. I mean, it's really hard to make snowfall measurements in general. And that group that you're talking about, the guy who leads that out of the Wisconsin, Nolan Doskin, his name is, has actually a good book out on how to measure it.
I had the video with everything they told you to do, but once we got that first 2 feet of snow on the ground, you went out, it was like impossible.
Yeah. Yep. You know, one thing you can do is, if you have one of those snowboards, is just wipe it all clean again. And try and start all over and just, keep records that you started all over.
I tried that, but what happened was a lot of those storms, we had those 30-mile-an-hour gusts, so everything was going sideways, nothing would collect on them.
Yep. And then, so do you have a precipitation gauge, too?
Right, I've got one of those gauges we're supposed to buy. They're really great with regular rain, and nothing would go in there properly because everything was sideways this winter.
Yeah, I mean, snowfall, as you're pointing out, is a really tough measurement to make. And that's why it's people like you that the National Weather Service really need. And that is a lot of people making these measurements and trying to do them accurately.
And I noticed at first with the regular stuff, I was always more than the airport. and more than some, it was interesting how the ones close to us, the difference between our readings, even though we all were doing it accurately. But then once winter got with these weird weather, it was just impossible.
Yeah. And then with the freezing rain, too, you know, you'd get, you know, if you get snow and then it rains and you didn't get out there, then the snow's gone. You don't have the measurement anymore. It's
right.
It's a tough problem. But keep it up. Don't give up. Do it again next year.
That's a good organization.
Oh, yeah. It's a great organization. And that data really gets distributed throughout the network, which is pretty much national. And I think they're actually going international.
After a big storm, you can go on there and look exactly, like just in Dane County or Wisconsin, where how much things differed. And it was unbelievable, the difference.
Yeah, snowfall really varies a lot. And that's why it's great having a lot of people measurement. The same thing with thunderstorms. You know, when you get precipitation, it really varies on a small time scale and distance. So you can really see big variations.
Well, they need lots of counters and readers, so I recommend it.
Thanks, Sherry.
All right, thank you.
I appreciate the call. And John Martin's joined us. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. How you doing? Hi, Steve.
Hi, John. You look wet. Did you not bring an umbrella with you?
I don't have an umbrella. Never owned one in my life. I don't mind. It's kind of glorious. A little bit of rain falling on your head.
It's a lot of rain.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Nicole in Madison has a question for you guys. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
Good. The previous caller actually started to give me some answers. I wanted to know what is a website that I can go to locally to see what the, you know, most recent totals were, you know, like when we get a big snowstorm or big rain. Yeah.
Yeah. The site that I usually go to first is the, and I'm trying to think of the web address and I'm not going to be able to do it, but there's the Midwest Climate Center.
Okay.
And if you search on
that,
yeah, they'll give you, you know, they give you a lot of variety of the current map, the last 7 days for the season. They give you a whole bunch of varieties.
Well, that's very cool.
And then the other one that the Sherry was talking about is it's called COCORA. It's got an odd acronym, COC something something R.
Well, that clears it up.
That worked.
If you search on snowfall measurement, you'll probably end up on this site.
Okay.
At some point, and you can look there. Sorry for not. And hopefully, Nolan, who's a good friend of mine who lives in Colorado, if he ever listens to this webcast, he's going to be very angry with me.
Thanks, Nicole.
Great. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it very much. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests as we talk weather here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking climate and weather now on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Steve Ackerman, professor and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Question for these guys, give us a call at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And lots of callers online, so we just go right to the phones here. And to Mark in Green Bay. Mark, hello.
Oh, hi. Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Sure.
On the 2nd of March, we had a thunderstorm that lasted almost 6 hours. Started at 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was still lightning at midnight. At the time, there was snow cover that extended all the way down to Des Moines. And I'm wondering, how was there enough energy to sustain something that long?
And it was rain.
It was raining off and on, but it was, you know, it was a pretty much persistent thunderstorm.
Yeah, I think the raining off and on is the key. I'm going to guess that it was I can't remember this exact event, but there were several that happened in late February and early March that here in Madison either missed us to the south or missed us to the north. And when that happens, it usually means that nothing's translating north or south. Instead, it's translating sort of southwest to northeast. And I'll bet you guys were just what we call trained. One storm after another came rolling over you, and that would account for the intermittent rain, but the fairly consistent or persistent thunder and lightning, that you're seeing the distant thunder and lightning from the storm that's just gone through you, and you're beginning to see the new thunder and lightning from the new storm coming toward you. And that can happen a lot. I remember that happening in the summertime quite often, that you get a situation where it seems to thunder and lightning all night long, but doesn't rain all night long. And that's probably what's going on.
Well, I can see in the summer that happening, they have really big temperature gradients, but it never really warmed up over here. We didn't have any warm rain at the back of it. And like I say, it was coming over at least 300 or 400 miles of snow cover. You wouldn't think that there would be enough energy behind it to have that kind of a storm front.
But the thing that actually drives those circulations in the wintertime relies on much stronger temperature contrasts, actually, than those that drive them in the summertime. And it doesn't have to be rooted at the surface. You can have mid-level convection or mid-level vertical motions driving such a thing. So it's quite possible that that's what it was.
Okay, thanks for your help.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. And more callers, Robert in McFarland. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Hey, yeah, a lot about the global warming. A lot of that trend is pretty well, I mean, I didn't really like it when you implied that people were stupid in running around saying things like we don't have global warming because our local weather is a little cooler than usual today or something like that. I don't hear anybody like that, and I hang around even working class people, God forbid, right? So if I'm in those kind of bars and I'm here that, not here that, I don't think it's really going on. But okay, nice segue. But the thing that's important to understand with global warming is it is a 1,500-year trend. That's pretty much been proven, thanks to the Danish and other people. Nobody here in this country would bother going to do that because there's no money in saying that, no sensationalism in saying that. It's a 1,500-year trend. It has less to do with human beings. We have all kinds of pollution we can go after if you want to go after it, and even weather patterns that might be changed by human beings in a local or regional area. But trying to imply that screwing in some fluorescent light bulbs while my university dean makes $300,000 a year is probably not going to have any effect. I live in a little shack over here, so if I screw in all the light bulbs in my shack, it won't offset that waste of money that they're paying for somebody to sit there and do a near-nothing job down at the university.
So. Okay, so what's the evidence for your point of view that it has nothing to do with...
Well, it's Singer, I think, and Avery, and the Danish that were drilling. You core into this, the things that have been around for a long time, like glaciers, are what you've got, and some certain sedimentary type structures all over the world, land structures around the world, but mostly the glaciers, and that evidence is fairly clear. Everybody in Europe accepts it. I accept it. Everybody here that's thinking accepts it. It's not a trend because you have too many automobiles. It's not a trend
That's not an accurate depiction of the comprehensive nature of the knowledge of this problem. It's cherry picking.
All right. So how do you respond then? So you're saying it's cherry picking to what?
To just pick on one aspect of evidence in a comprehensive scientific argument. That's what the anti-evolution people do, too. They pick on one thing. How can you explain how this bird turned into this dinosaur turned into this bird? And if you can't explain that one thing, then people will say, oh, your whole theory's wrong, which is, of course, a pretty crazy way to approach a long logical thought process. There is evidence that there are long-term trends in the climate system, and no one disputes that. But the fact that in the last 150 years, the increase in carbon dioxide has been faster than anything in the last 600,000 years, and the rate of temperature increase has also been faster than anything in the last 600,000 years, that we can recreate as best we can by doing the very things that the caller is talking about, drilling into ice cores, things that have been around for a long time, and figuring out what the chemical composition of the atmosphere was. There is, at some point, one has to admit, and I'm happy to admit it, that there's a lot of circumstantial argument that can be made about the connections. But boy, oh boy, there's a very, very little wiggle room, in my mind, on alternative hypotheses. And the one that we just heard is simply not comprehensive.
No.
I mean, yeah, I would totally agree. I mean, what you want is you want to have a whole bunch of data pointing to the same physical process that explains what those data are telling you. And that's what we have in global warming in the last 150 years.
That's
We're
right.
seeing trends and changes that not just in one piece of measurement, but in a lot of natural conditions as well, in terms of glaciers, in terms of growing seasons and things like that. And they all can be explained. Well, a single explanation can really do a lot of explaining what's going on.
And what harm could possibly come from everybody maybe rethinking the way they do business? And not everybody can rethink it in the same way. But we really do have opportunities now to use more efficient lighting and things like this. And I think there's no good argument for not doing it. There are other battles that the caller brings up, and there's plenty of opinions on those things, but how we're spending our money in the state and all that. But boy, oh boy, we can do better on our energy efficiency, and we should strive for that, regardless of any other problem that might exist in our state or in our nation.
We should always look at what we're doing and how we can do it better.
Sure, why not?
Whether it's light bulbs or...
That's what Bo Ryan does at halftime.
Right, yeah,
he says,
right.
What are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? And that's why they won 31 games.
Right. And sometimes you don't quite figure it out.
You don't quite figure it out. Robert, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Yvonne in Brown Deer has got a question for us. Let's go to Yvonne. Hi.
Yes. How much of this water are we going to retain in our underground areas?
That's another good question. We've got, and you're in Brown Deer area, so down eastern Wisconsin.
Right. Well, sort of.
Yeah.
Well,
sort of.
Yeah. The The one thing I didn't look at before I came over here was the depth at which the ground is frozen. So if the ground, you know, up on the surface, it's not frozen. But if it, the ground, you go not too far into the ground and it's frozen, then a lot of this water is not.
I can tell you what's happening in my yard.
It's just running off, right?
No, the tulips are arriving.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
And the maple syrup is, or the sap is running.
We were lucky in some ways, at least in the southern part of the state, to have that snow start. December 1st was the beginning of snow cover season, and it never looked back. And as a consequence, I think the ground never really got a chance to freeze through any significant depth. In fact, somebody was saying to me, I wish I remembered who it was very wise not long ago. And he said, well, notice that when things are melting, oh, it's the groundskeeper at the West Madison Little League. His first name's Paul. This is a really intelligent guy. And he said, notice that when everything's melting on these warm days, you're not seeing big rivers of water flowing off of lawns, even if they're on a hill. It's because the ground is not frozen,
right,
and all that water is sinking in. So I think this, I don't know for agriculture whether that's good or bad in the spring, but I know that that is different from many of our winters, that we're going to have a lot of water absorbed into the ground this spring.
Well, it certainly is good. As parts of Wisconsin we've gone a couple of years of really dry conditions, I think in the north more than in the south.
Yeah.
So it's bound to help up there, I would assume, if we've got the same conditions there. You know, and this is, I used to have a guy on by the name of Art Peterson, who was a soil scientist, and this time of the year, he'd come on and report on what the funeral directors and cemetery officials had to say about the frost depth.
Yeah.
And we kept that report, and I'm not sure that those reports are still kept, but those guys are out there digging graves.
That's a great source of information for this problem, you bet.
And he was very, very accurate every year in predicting whether or not we were going to have flooding based on his reports from the funeral directors and cemetery officials.
Yeah.
Makes perfect sense.
I need to call him up.
Yeah.
He's retired now. Good
so
guy.
It sounds like it's good news for you.
Yeah. Did they call that double tasking?
Yeah, sort of.
Okay, thank you.
All right, it was a grave situation. Russ in Pewaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Russ.
Hello. I've got a question on lightning.
Okay.
If lightning, starts from the ground up, and I'm assuming it needs to be grounded, how dangerous is it to be out on a lake, and why? Would you be safer on land, or if you're fishing in a remote area or something? I don't know, maybe an aluminum boat. How do you get struck by lightning out there if it needs to be grounded, or does it?
Usually when people talk about the lightning goes from the ground up, they're usually talking about the current flow. So what happens is that, you get this really big separation of charges between the cloud and the ground, like a big static electric spark. And as that difference builds up, there are actually, I like to think of them almost like clear air wires. You actually get past trying to work its way through the atmosphere, like trying to set up a wire between the cloud and the ground of which the current can flow through. And once that gets set up, then it goes typically, but not always, from the ground upwards. And so being out on the lake is actually worse because as that imaginary wire, if you will, is trying to make its way down to the ground. It's trying to find the closest distance. And so if you're out on a lake and that's the way it's heading, then you're above the lake, so you're the closest distance. So that's where it's going to be heading towards.
So your best bet is to get off, and if you're surrounded by woods, go into the woods and be near smaller trees.
And hope.
Yeah.
And
the smallest trees is a big thing, yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Russ. Thanks for calling. Dave in Pewaukee is up next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a quick question. I was just wondering if you can define what the rate at which the temperature decreases as altitude increases, let's say between sea level and 15,000 feet above sea level.
The average, if I remember right, is about 6.6 degrees Celsius for every kilometer.
Right, and 15,000 feet is about 2.5 kilometers or something like that. Is that right? No, it's more than that.
Yeah.
It's 3 miles, so it's about to 3.6 kilometers. So temperature probably drops about 25, 23 degrees, 24 degrees Celsius by the time you get to 15,000 feet.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Phil in Belleville, your turn. Hi, Phil.
Hi, thank you. I'm a member of this Cocoa Roz.
Oh, you are? Great.
Thank you.
What does it stand for?
Pardon?
What does it stand for? This is the snow measurement.
Yeah, it's Community Collaborative Rain and Hail and Snow Network.
Ah, right.
But I think you could just put Cocoa Roz, C-O-C-O-R-A-H-S, and I think you'd find the site.
Yep.
But each morning, you need a rain gauge. And for about $30, you could probably get your post and your rain gauge. And everybody has the same rain gauge. And they would like you to do it at 7 o'clock. And it goes to Fort Collins, Colorado. And that way they know what precipitation there's been. But I'm the only one in Greene County. I don't think there's nobody in Lafayette. But they have a drive right now, and Wisconsin is way behind. There's some states that have picked up almost 30 new people. So if you got any interest or whatever, it's kind of a neat thing to do. And there's a site there you could look up, see what other people have for rain or snow or...
Yeah, and I'm going to just give you people my email, so if they don't want to go look it up or figure it out but want to participate, I can put them in contact with the right person.
Okay.
So my email is Steve A, S-T-E-V-E-A, at ssec.wisc.edu. Yeah, because Nolan, the guy who leads that, came up to Wisconsin and... we met him at the American Meteorological Society's annual meeting, and he really pushed it, and he said the same thing. He said, Wisconsin, you know, behind the ball in making contributions.
Yeah. So what's that website again? Your email
My
address?
Email is Steve A, S-T-E-V-E-A, at ssec.wisc.edu.
Right.
And I'll put you in contact with Nolan and his group. It's a great group of people, and it's a lot of fun to participate. I do know some people who participate, and I was going to participate this year, but I went on sabbatical, so I couldn't do it every day.
All right. Thanks, Phil.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, and I went online to Cocoa Roz, C-O-C-O-R-A-H-S, and
that's it.
Millions of hits there.
Yeah,
so
yeah. It's a great group. And they measure hail, too. They have a very creative way of measuring hail.
Oh, how do they do it?
That's a lot of fun. They put out a styrofoam board, and they cover it very carefully with aluminum foil. And so when it rains, it leaves an imprint.
Yeah.
And then you just go out there and you measure all the imprints, and then you report it.
Cool.
It's great.
Vern in Appleton.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
Say, I'd like to ask you, I have noticed that sometimes there'll be a precipitation, and it's white. It looks like snow, except it's not in flakes.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
just a little round thing.
Yeah.
And it's soft. It's not ice. You can squeeze it with your fingers. What is that, and how does it made?
I think that's grapple, right?
Yeah, right.
It's usually...
Pellets.
Or snow pellets, yeah. They can start out as really, really small ice crystals, and then they start to get larger by riming, a process called riming. They're falling through super-cooled water in a cloud, and as soon as they make contact with it, it freezes into ice. And I don't know how they maintain the slight crystalline structure that they have, because they do look like little pieces of styrofoam, you know, and you get in your packaging, don't they, Vern, a little
exactly,
bit?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I don't know how they keep a slight crystalline structure instead of just accreting as sort of a sleet particle. That I don't know, but I know that they're rimed particles. Just like if you're out on a ship and it's cold and you get that sea spray that kind of rimes up on the rigging. It's the same exact kind of process, although it's happening in the cloud.
Huh. Well, I've often noticed it, and I mean, you can't really say it was a snow or anything. I don't know why I thought of it today while you're on, but I've really been curious about that.
Well, I'm glad you called.
And it's just as soft. I mean, you know, you don't feel any ice in it.
Yeah, right.
When it hits the ground, it just breaks apart.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and for me, it was always, when I was growing up in New England, whenever that kind of rimed ice snow would start to fall, I always thought, oh, it's just about to change over to rain, because there it was a transition thing. Here, it can hang on a long time and snow that way for quite some time before it, and sometimes it won't change, but in New England, it always was a harbinger of the end of the snowstorm. It used to drive me crazy.
Well, there's some benefits to Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. There's
all
a whole
right.
bunch of them.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, nice. Vern. Thanks for calling. Joe in Milwaukee is up next. Joe, hello.
Hi there. Great show. Very interesting. And I just had a question. I'm sort of on the fence about the global warming issue, and I just had a question for you guys. I saw a video in which one of the lead authors of the UN study on global climate change was interviewed, and his opinion was that he agreed with all of the subsets of the paper, you know, citing that these changes are occurring, that completely disagreed with the final analysis that it was clearly caused by man. I was wondering if you were familiar with that scientist and what you thought of his opinions.
What's his name?
What's the individual's name, you know?
I wish I did. it was a while ago that I saw it, so I don't recall his name.
Yeah.
If you're not familiar with him, that's fine. You know, you might check it out on the internet, though. I'm sure you could probably find.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that, unfortunately, Joe. I don't know that story.
But you disagree with it?
No, I would want to weigh the evidence. I'd want to know what the person said. One of the things people have been saying about this might be quite opposite, quite different from what Joe's talking about, but people have been bringing up this Danish scientist, this statistician. And really, at the base of his argument is the following thing, that global warming is a problem. But when one compares it statistically to other problems that the world faces, it's not the number one problem. And he comes to that conclusion from a statistical analysis of cost-benefit. A lot of people are using that statement, which they're not, of course, replicating accurately, to say this Danish scientist, an esteemed statistician, is saying this isn't a problem at all. That's a big difference. I don't know if that's the guy that Joe's talking about, but his words have been warped by the media. And I don't think it's one-sided media. I think it's just been warped by the media because they have this tendency to want to draw battles out in the media. And actually, when you read his statements, they don't say anything like what he's been purported to have said.
This individual was a lead scientist on the global warming, on the UN study of global climate change.
Yeah, I'm going to take I'll take a look. I haven't heard of that, though.
Yeah, but it wouldn't surprise me too much in the sense that, you know, they came to a common conclusion that, yes, global warming is occurring. Human activities are contributing to it, but there's still a lot of things that we can't explain, particularly right. When you start trying to break things down to regional impacts, you know, what's going to happen in a particular place at a, you know, 20 years from now.
Yeah,
still a lot of work on that.
I agree, and I myself, it's funny you say that, Steve, because I was reading over the IPCC report for a presentation I had to give last week, and there were a couple of things in there that are consensus opinion. Mm-hmm. That are based on thousands of studies, with which I really have some questions. I'd love to get the people who had a hand in making the consensus in a room and say, why did you say this? Why did you think this? Because I'm not sure I understand it. So it's not that everybody 100% is on board, but it's a consensus document.
Yeah. Mm. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks, Joe. And Mary in Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Yes, talking of the media, how come I'm not hearing anything about methane? You hear about carbon dioxide and other gases, but there's a model, and I don't have cable TV, but no one really talks about it.
Yeah, you know, every now and then it pops its head up, and usually in two ways. One is cow contributions to methane, which is kind of the joking end of it. And then every now and then they talk about it. It comes up, and I see this more common on the Discovery Channel as opposed to local channels. And that is, there's methane deposits deep within the ocean, and what happens if those methane deposits were to be released by some change in ocean temperature or circulations or something like that. Mm. They don't pop up that often, but they do come up every now and then. And I'm trying to think of what would be like once a year or something, but I'd be afraid to put a number on it.
Yeah, I was trying to remember. I think I've read that, too, or maybe watched it on the Discovery Channel.
Yeah, the Discovery Channel, I know, just recently, within the last 4 or 5 months, did a program where I think it was mostly talking about ice, but then they got into methane ice instead of water ice.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'd say that maybe the media doesn't have its eye on it, but the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change
has
a whole chapter on methane or a big section on it, and it shows up on every one of their graphs of trace gases. So they've got their eye on the methane, and it's following the same trend as the carbon dioxide. Yep. But there isn't as much of it in the atmosphere, I think.
Right, which means it has potentially a bigger impact because of the way it affects.
Yeah, the percentage change could be much bigger, right.
Mm. Thank you, Mary. Appreciate your call very much. And Steve and John, here we are, out of time.
At the end of another month.
Yep.
At the end of another month. Oh, my goodness. Well, you'll be back the last Monday of next month.
Of April.
Yes, sir. We will.
Sounds good to me.
And we'll do this all over again. Steve Ackerman, excuse me, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, our weather guys, and they will be back the last Monday in April. Looking forward to that. And, of course, we're always looking forward to what's coming up tomorrow on the program. And tomorrow, Phil Pelletieri, our University of Wisconsin Extension entomologist, he's directs the involved in the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison campus. And he'll be talking with us about probably butterflies a little bit and other insects. That's on tomorrow's program. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.